Hi, this is part five, the fifth century. Fifth century, rather. 2,000 years, the Jewish Odyssey, and it was sponsored again by Becky Navikatz, Leland Shmas, Yonah Ben Rabar-Yaleh, Tanya Shmoso, Sura Batsarachayim. The last outstanding personality of the Talmudic era was Rav Ashi. Rav Ashi succeeded Rav Papa as the spiritual leader in Bavel in 371. He died in 427. That is, he served in the same position for 56 years, long time. 56 years as the Gadol HaDor. And this is part of the spiritual continuity of Jewish life, that we're never left without great Torah leaders. Sometimes we think that way and someone appears. This is the Gemara in Kiddush and Davayin Bezim at Bez. Kishemes Rava Nolad Rav Ashi. When Rava died, Rav Ashi was born. Lamedcha Shein Tzadik Niftam in Ha'olam Achinivra Tzadik Kamoso. To teach us that a tzaddik does not leave this world until he has his replacement already in existence. That's the pasuk V'zar HaShemesh U'va HaShemesh. A sun rises even before another sun sets. Last week we discussed Rava died in the year 352. That means that Rav Ashi became a Rosh Yeshiva at the tender age of 19. He was young. That was a reflection as much on his ability as it was of necessity. But it really was more of his ability. Is the Gemara in Gittin, Daf Nun Tesamad Bez. Mimos Rebbe v'ad Rav Ashi lo matzinu Torah gedula b'mokom echad. From the time Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi died until Rav Ashi, we don't find Torah and greatness, meaning Torah and material slash political greatness, in one place. V'lo, how could you say that? V'ha'hava Huna Bar Nosson. At the same time as Rav Ashi lived, Huna Bar Nosson was the Reish Shalusa. So he was also a Talmud Chacham, and he was also very wealthy like Rav Ashi was. So the Gemara says, Shiny Huna Bar Nosson, the Mechav Hava Kayifle L'Rav Ashi. Even though Huna Bar Nosson was the Reish Galusa and the titular head of Babylonian Jewry and a Talmud Chacham to boot, even he, Huna, was subservient to Rav Ashi. That was his greatness. Early in his tenure, Rav Ashi moved the center of Jewish life in Bavel from Sura to what became a very famous Talmudic town, Mosa Machasya. Mosa means city, so it's Machasya City, like New York City, meaning it was a central place, and he made it the focal point of learning. So much so that Rav Ashi convened special days of learning on Yom Tov and other occasions, we'll discuss a little later. He moved what was called the Rigla de Reish Galusa. Every year there's a special Shabbos set aside, Shabbos Parshas Lech Lecha, to honor the Reish Galusa, and all the Talmidei Chacham would come to Shul and pay tribute to the Reish Galusa. He moved that from Sura to Machasya. So in fact, the Reish Galusa himself came to Mosa Machasya, and the other Amoram came from Pumbedisa to Mosa Machasya as well. Gemara tells a number of stories about Rav Ashi that testify to his personal character. So Gemara Baba Basra, Daf Gimel Amud Beis, when cracks appeared in the walls of the great shul in Mosa Machasya, he ordered the shul demolished and rebuilt. As the Gemara says, how could he do that? Halach is you can't tear down a shul unless you've already built its replacement, lest the people be left without one. So the Gemara answers, this was different because Rav Ashi moved his bed into the demolished premises and slept there and didn't remove it until the gutters and the pipes were installed and the building was up. This would light a fire under the contractors as well as, I suppose, the fundraisers. Rav Ashi insisted that no house be higher than the shul, Allah, which is commonly disregarded, but he says in Shabbos, Daf Yud Aleph, Amud Aleph, Ana Avde L'Mosa Machasa D'Lo Charva. I was the one who saw to it that it wasn't destroyed, because he insisted that no house have a roof higher than the shul. So the Gemara asks, V'ha Charva? But in fact, Mosa Machasa was destroyed. So the Gemara answers, May also avon lo charva. From that sin of having houses higher than the shul, it was not destroyed, but for other reasons. Rav Ashi is famous or responsible at least, for one of the most famous customs, but misunderstood customs in Jewish life. Gemara says in Brachos, Daf Lamed Aleph, Amud Aleph, Rav Ashi Ovad Hilula Livrei, he made a wedding for his son, Chazinu L'Rabbanan Dehava Kabad Chaytuva, he saw that the rabbis were carrying on frivolously. You know how rabbis can get at weddings. Aisi Kasa Dezugisa Chivarta, he took a white crystal glass, an expensive glass, the Tavar Kamayu, and he shattered the glass in front of them, Vatsivu, and they became a little saddened, meaning that dampened the mood. This is actually the source for the common custom now, Jewish weddings, to break a glass. The association with the Churban came much later in Jewish life. Originally it was done just to make sure things did not get out of hand. Things were joyous but sober at weddings. I gave a shiur years ago on the breaking of the glass at a wedding today. So one of the things I just mentioned, Agav Urcho, which is always puzzling, is that when the glass is broken, people yell at Mazel Tov. So it's inappropriate from two perspectives. Either because we break the glass, Zecher L'Churban, it's tantamount to saying, Mazel Tov, the Beis HaMikdash is still destroyed. Or it's done to dampen the mood. It's done as an act of sadness, not as an act. So if you've noticed, at the weddings where I officiate, I break the glass in the middle of a Meshkacheich. So when it finishes, the glass is already broken, and people yell out what they want, others hurry off to the dinner. Now Rav Ashi, of course, was responsible for the great work of Jewish history, the compilation of part of the Torah Shebaal Peh, known as the Talmud Bavli. Rav Ashi was the first and the primary editor of the Talmud Bavli. There are obviously many, many others. But we first need to look at the world situation, which, just like the publication of the Mishnah at the end of the second century, made this an especially opportune and even indispensable time to undertake this monumental work. In other words, why did Rav Ashi undertake this project at this time? Let's look at some of the world news then. Well, we recall from last time that the land of Israel had declined in significance under the heavy hand of a re-Christianized Roman Empire after the short reign of Julian the Apostate. The Roman part of the Roman Empire that ruled over Eretz Yisrael was the Byzantine Empire. Rome in the 5th century would soon fall into a very steep decline, until the Roman Empire, the Western Roman Empire, was actually destroyed. You all recall Gibbon's The Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire. So it was destroyed in 476. It took place, we'll get to it tonight. That would usher in the fall of Rome, according to many historians, ushered in the period famously known as the Dark Ages of European life that lasted centuries. Now, Rome's fall began earlier than that, and had both anticipated and unanticipated effects on Jews, especially the Jews of Bavel, which until this century really never came under the thumb of Rome. In 410, Rome was sacked for the first time by the Visigoths, and it was left reeling. That in itself was a stunning, earth-shaking event from a number of perspectives. Obviously, Rome was a political power. Now the decline was hastened. Rome wasn't just a political capital, it was also the spiritual core of Christianity. So keep in mind, one of the arguments that Christians always made as to the truth of their religion and the falsity, Rahman al-Islam, of the Torah, is that the Jews were dispersed and they had no independence and they were downtrodden. And now the same thing happened in the center of Christianity. It was then, after the first fall of Rome in 410, that one of the leading figures in Christian history, Augustine, wrote a book called The City of God, in which he redefined what it meant to be a Christian and what Christian politics or governance was to be like. The City of God was about the struggle between the earthly and the heavenly, and about how the righteous eschew the pleasures of this world and devote themselves to spreading religious, that is to say, Christian values. And he wrote that Rome fell because they neglected the faith, and they tolerated paganism and immorality. Augustine was born in 354 in North Africa. He was raised a Catholic by his mother, but he rebelled. And as we know famously, because one of his famous books, if not the most famous, is The Confessions of Augustine, he had a very dissolute existence in his young years. He became a hedonist, something of a rogue. In Augustine's famous prayer of his youth, he would say, "Lord, grant me chastity, but just not yet." And that's how he lived his life. He felt that way, and he lived such a life until he fell under the influence of Ambrose, who you recall was the Bishop of Milan, who baptized him. And under Ambrose's direction, Augustine became a priest, a bishop, a prolific writer and philosopher, oldest continuously occupied city in America, is named after him, St. Augustine, Florida, from 1565. He brought to Christianity the ideas of original sin and man's fall, and to the Christian world, and really to the Western world, the idea of a just war. What justifies war? Not that they ever followed it. Now, the City of God, the book was based on, or was to be based on love. Unfortunately, none of that love was to be directed to Jews. And Augustine was a rabid Jew hater, like his mentor Ambrose. But he became a very important figure in our history, and that's why I mention it. In Ambrose, for example, was a rabid Jew hater. Early in his tenure as bishop, the Jews of a city on the Euphrates were massacred in a pogrom, and the shul was destroyed. And the Byzantine emperor, Theodosius I, we mentioned him last week, who was a benevolent chap, decided to rebuild the shul from the government treasury to show that he didn't approve of such actions. Ambrose wrote him a letter saying such a thing is usur under Christianity, and it would be a disgrace if that was done. And he wrote that he would burn down the shul in Milan if not for the fact that God had done it for him by a bolt of lightning that had set the shul on fire. That was Augustine's mentor, Ambrose. In 387, after hateful sermons by St. John Chrysostom, who was the Bishop of Antioch, a very hard time calling Augustine or Ambrose or John Chrysostom saints, but nonetheless, that's their title. Well, after his sermons, the Jews of Antioch were brutally massacred, and their shul was destroyed, and for the first time, this is 387, a charge of ritual murder, blood libel, was lodged against the Jewish people. Not long after Rome's initial defeat, the Jewish community of Alexandria was destroyed in 414. All of this by Christians. So it's ironic that Augustine becomes an unwitting, and I emphasize unwitting, savior of the Jews. How so? He differed from Ambrose, who couldn't care less whether Jews survived. Augustine's approach, which he articulated and wrote about in City of God, was that the Jews were cast off by God, and he called on all Jews to repent and to join the church, but he explicitly opposed the extermination of Israel, because he said, "We were," and I quote, "the world's witnesses to the prophecies which were given beforehand concerning Christ." Therefore, Augustine articulated the notion that Jews were not to be slaughtered, but Jews were to be scattered. So wherever there are Christians, there'll be Jews as well, whom he called the witnesses. In the words of James Carroll, the thrust of Augustine's approach was that we would be allowed to survive, but never to thrive. And our homelessness and misery were the proper punishments for our perfidy in not recognizing Christianity. It had an ironic effect, because what came out is that unlike paganism that disappeared because the tribes, the nationalities, were either massacred or assimilated into Rome, Judaism, because of Augustine's philosophy, was permitted to endure. Mendelssohn later wrote that but for Augustine's, what he called, lovely brainwave, we would have been exterminated long ago. Of course, we don't accept that. Hashgacha prevails overall. But Augustine was influential enough that his view that the Jew should live, live poorly, but live, in order to prove the truth of Christianity, for the most part was accepted. Jews will be persecuted, but not slaughtered outright. Now, the problem, of course, as we move through the centuries, is that some of this nuance was often lost on the Christian mobs after they were reminded by their preachers of the treachery of the Jews. But you do have these two trends in Christianity. The Augustinian, which said, let the Jews live, which for the most part predominated, and Ambrosian or other philosophers later on who just said kill them entirely. For the most part, Augustine's view prevailed. Part of that was that Jews should have no visible sign of greatness or independence or prominence. So when the Christians reasserted control over Israel in the 420s, they once and for all abolished the Nicaeus, and the house of Hillel ceased to exist in 425 after almost five centuries of leadership. Rav Ashi's tenure in Bavel coincided for two decades with the rule of another benevolent king, the Parthian ruler called Yazdegerd, Yazdegerd the first. In the language of the Gemara, he's called Izdegar. Yazdegerd in Persian means made by God. Well, if you're a king, it's a good name to have. He was a peaceful personality. Even Rome made no moves on Parthia in his time. And he had very warm relations, did Yazdegerd the first, with Rav Ashi and the Chacham of the times. The Gemara tells a very beautiful vignette in Zvachim, Daf Yotes Amad Aleph, Rav Ashi. Rav Ashi said, Amar li Huna ben Nosan, Huna bar Nosan, the Reish Galusa, told this story to Rav Ashi. Zimna chada hava kaima kame de Izdegar Malka. Huna said, I was once in the palace of Izdegar Malka, and was socializing or an audience with him. The hava madle li hamione vitese niale. And my belt, his gartel, rose up at a crooked angle. And Yazdegerd walked over to him and lowered it, so it should, himself lowered it, so it should look presentable. V'amali, and Izdegar Malka said to Huna, Mamlechas Kani V'gai Kadosh K'siv B'chu. It says about you that you are kingdom of priests in a holy nation. How do you walk around with your clothing all askew? Ki Osek Kamed Amemar. He came to Amemar, he said, Amar Li Akaim B'cha, you fulfilled the Pasuk in Yeshayahu, V'hayu Melachim Omenecha, that the kings of the nations will be your nursemaids, meaning your helpers. So clearly, relations were good. Izdegar flirted for a time with Christianity, and then he became a persecutor of the Christians, and returning later in his life to Zoroastrianism. But when he died in 419, as often happened, a civil war broke out for several years among his sons and others. Eventually, he was succeeded by his son Bahram V, who was also friendly to Jews. There are credible reports that his mother, the mother of Bahram V, meaning the wife of Yazdegerd I, Shoshanducht, was Jewish. Not only Jewish, but the daughter of the Reish Galusa. So some of the accounts of the times refer to a Jewish princess marrying the king of Persia, which of course in Persia resonated due to Esther Hamalka. He, Bahram V, ruled for less than two decades. He also persecuted Christians, and that led to a war with a barely breathing Byzantine Empire, and it was Bahram V's armies that were defeated in several battles until they, the Persians, sued for peace. He was also invaded by the Huns, so by his death in 438, this Bahram V, who called himself the great Shah of Persia, had left his kingdom destabilized. We would pay a price for that, as the peace treaty that he made with the Byzantines for the first time allowed Christians to enter Persia, and this eventually aroused the resentment of the Zoroastrian priests, who were very quick to act.
Bahram was succeeded by Yazdegerd II. Yazdegerd ruled until 457. He waged a more successful war against Rome, after which, led by the Zoroastrian priests, he began a sustained persecution of Christians, and then in the 440s, of Jews. One of the few times during the period of the Amoraim that Jews were persecuted. So Yazdegerd II had a host of evil decrees against the Klal Yisrael. He banned the observance of Shabbos, and most well known, he banned the recitation of Kriyat Shema on pain of death, even dispatching guards to go to shul every morning to verify that Jews were not saying Kriyat Shema. So this led to an innovation in Jewish life that remains until today. That's why we say Kriyat Shema during Birchas HaShachar in La'olam Yehei Odom, because they knew when Kriyat Shema would be recited before the Shemon Esrei. They'd have to come at the beginning. They came, you know, like a lot of Jews do. Baruch Shema, Yishtabach, Hashrei. Who's coming at the beginning? Additionally, Chazal also instituted that we would say Kriyat Shema in the Kedusha of Musaf on Shabbos and Yom Tov for the same reason. I imagine the reason was Jews were not coming to shul as early on Shabbos as they would during the week. They come late. So they came late. They missed the Kriyat Shema of Birchas HaShachar to say Kriyat Shema in Musaf. Even after the Zman Sanu, they would say privately, but the Tzibur they would say because the guards would leave after the Zman Kriyat Shema had ended. We still have that minhag, of course. It's still part of the davening. What's that? Berger Shema and Baruch Hashem. That's it. There's one pasuk. Rav Shreira Gaon records in his Igeres that Yazdegerd came to an untimely end, timely for us. Chazal decreed a fast day. Bo Rachameh, they prayed. Uva Leitanino, he was swallowed by a serpent. Liyazdegerd Malka Bevei Mishkavo, a serpent entered his bedroom and bit him and killed him. What others suggest was a successful assassination that in due course halted these persecutions. V'chein Hoya, Yazdegerd II was executed by his successor. Now there will be another wave of persecutions a decade or so later, but by then the magnum opus of Babylonian Jewry was nearly completed, and that brings us to the Talmud Bavli. It's hard to overestimate the significance of the Talmud to the Jewish people. Simply put, historically, where the Talmud was studied, Jews survived. Where the Talmud was not studied, Jews did not or do not survive. Well, we survive only because we're singled out for persecution, but then we don't survive with any type of rich Jewish life. Observance becomes impossible. Lack of Talmud Torah always greases the wheels toward assimilation and disappearance. And the Talmud is a brake if a Jew embraces it. So what is the Talmud, and how the Talmud Bavli, and how was it put together? Let's look at the structure first. The Talmud was the culmination of the work of the Amoraim, of whom just a small fraction, 2,200, are mentioned by name in the Talmud Bavli. The Talmud essentially are discussions on the Mishnah, dating from the time of Rebbe, but incorporating the teachings of many earlier sages as well. Rav Shreira Gaon writes, Itosfa Hora Dora Achar Dora. Every generation from the time of the Mishnah on added its teachings, new applications, sometimes new machlokos, until the time of Ravina. Says the Gemara Baba Metzia, Daf Pei Vav Amud Aleph, Ravashi veRavina Sof Hora. Ravashi and Ravina, they were the end of the period of Hora, of the Amoraim, the end of that period of teaching. The Simonach LeGemara is a play on words. It says in Tehillim, Adavo Miktoshi, Miktolak Ravashi, Avina Lachrisom, it's like Ravina. Now, when the Gemara says Ravashi veRavina, it's a reference to Ravina the second, who died in 475, and thus that date is often used for the final publication of the Talmud. There was another Ravina, we'll call him Ravina the First, who was a little older than Ravashi. He'd been a young Talmud of Rava, and then he became a colleague of Ravashi, even though Ravashi was a little younger than him. and Ravina was subordinate to Ravashi, but Ravashi assisted Ravina, Ravina assisted Ravashi substantially in his work. What did he actually do? So Rashi says, there by Metzia, Sof Hora, Sof Kol Amoroin. It's the end of the period of the Amoroim. Ad Yimehem Lohoisa Gemara Ala Seder. Until their time, there was no Gemara, there was no teaching on the Mishnah that was ordered, that was structured. El Shehoisa Sheila Nishelas Betam HaMishnah Beveis HaMedrish. Until that time, we're talking at least 2.5 centuries, well, there was a question raised on what Rebbe meant by something in the Mishnah. Or a question, how do you handle a particular case in monetary law, or a particular case of Issa Veheter, Kashrus, Anida, or the like? Each person gave his reason, but it was haphazard, it was scattershot. Whatever was being discussed, someone would have something to say, or they'd look elsewhere. Veravashi, Veravino, Sidru Shmuel Samaron Shalifnehen. They arranged the teachings of all the Amorim that came before them in written form. Vekavu al Seidam Asechtos Kolechad Vecha Etzal Mishnah Ruya Vashnuyalo. And they established it on the particular Masechta, on those Mishnayos, that's appropriate for that particular discussion. Sometimes there's overlap also. You know, some Gemaras are mentioning a number of Masechtos. And then additionally, the Hikshu Kushya, they didn't just explain the Mishnah, but the Hikshu Kushyos, Sheish Lashiv, they ask questions. They record the questions, so subsequent generations will not be puzzled by them. Questions with the answers. Uperukim Shuyim Lutarets. Hein Bamorim Shemahem. The answer they also gave. So Yvakovu Akol B'Gemar, they wrote it down in a specific form. And that became, that's the Shakla B'Tarya. That's the ebb and flow, the entire discussion in the Gemara. It starts with a statement from the Mishnah, and then someone will, and then they'll bring a contrasting opinion, Esave, Mesave, Viraminu, Ibayelahu, and that's how the essential halacha is determined. And they raise the question, Vateritzim Shalehen, I'm still reading from Rashi, and the appropriate answers, Mashashiyaro Sanchalafnehem, whatever was left from before. Vaosan Shamar Lafnehem, Akushas Vateritzim Shalehem, Lokfon, the Gemara, Sadam Sakbos, Vamishisita Rebbe, Ubor Ravashi Ravinu Kvom, all the questions and answers that were not put in the Gemara on the Seder, that's what Ravina Ravashi put in this form. Of the 63 Masechtos in the Shas, only 37 have Talmud Bavli on them. And if you want to just generalize, these discussions are primarily of Rav and Shmuel, Abaye and Rava, and their disciples. They were the subjects of the intensive Talmud Torah overseen by Ravashi on Masa Machasya on a systematic basis. And this is what makes the editing of the Talmud so interesting, because it really was a communal project that involved a large number of Jews. How so? Ravashi institutionalized the Yarchei Kala. You remember from a few weeks ago, Yarchei Kala, Jews would gather in Adar and Elul before the Yom Tovim and spend a month learning. Ravashi institutionalized it, so it wasn't just random. Again, from Rav Shiragon in his Igeres, it's from the 10th century. So, Hochi Tekinu L'Rabbanu L'masne B'chol Shosa V'Shosa Tartin M'sechta Hein Choser V'Hein Yoser. At every Yarchei Kala, Ravashi ordained that they would study two Masechtos, two of the 60 that existed in Shas then. You recall again, the Babas were one and Sanhedrin Makos were one also. Whether it was a long Masechta, short Masechta, didn't matter. They would do two Masechtos in Adar, two Masechtos in Elul. The Har Talmuda Kulei Betlosin Shnin comes out then, 60 Masechtos, two Masechtos a year. How long did it take them to go through all of Shas? Be'iyun, 30 years. V'chevin Ravashi malach l'karav shesin shnin. Since Ravashi was the Gadol Hador for almost 60 years, havu hochi tre maduri yishchiv b'shnas tovshin lamedches. They're able to review each mesechta twice. So from these discussions, which were very ordered, very focused, the Talmud arose. Since Ravashi died, tovshin lamedches, the year 427, comes out that each Masechta was reviewed twice systematically. And they would announce the two Masechtas that they study in Adar when they finished in Elul. And when they finished in Elul, the Archikala, they announced what two Masechtas they'd be studying in Adar. So everyone would come with their teachings, because he reigned more than 60 years, almost 60 years, the Masechtas were studied twice. Interestingly, the Gemara refers, as it always does cryptically, to this event. In Baba Basra, Daf Kuf Nun Zayin Mud Beis, they're learning a certain area, and the Gemara says that a Talmud reported, B'mahadura kamadu Ravashi Omar Lan Hochi. The first time we learned this with Ravashi, in the first cycle, he taught us this. Uvamahadura Basra de Ravashi Omarlon Ba'ampa Achri. The second time we learned it with him, he said something different. Just like 7 centuries later, Rashi's students would write down his teachings, but also with different nuances. Each time you learn something, you learn it new. New ideas come, new formulas are presented, everything seems to be new. You build on the past. So that's why the first cycle and the second cycle, and between all of that, we have the Talmud. The process was begun by Ravashi. The basic format and the texts were assembled, as with the Mishnah. The private notebooks that had recorded discussions were invaluable and often traced the very thought process of the Shir. For 1,000 years hence, the handwritten copies of the Talmud were indispensable and invaluable to Jewish life. Very difficult to procure, not durable because of the technology of the time, ink and paper, and because of the wickedness of various foes, the Talmud becoming that book which the nations of the world, especially the Christians, couldn't burn often enough from their perspective. Now, the Talmud is seemingly one long discussion, often with tangents that are mystifying to the novice, but with an internal order that is breathtaking. One of the ingenious tactics of the Talmud is to have a discussion that transcends generations, as in an earlier Amora or even a Tana will be said to hold the opinion of a later Amora, someone who wasn't even alive in his lifetime. Or in a very familiar locution in the Talmud, they'll say, Omar Loch, that is to say, someone long deceased answers the question of an Amora. Omar Loch means he would have said, had he actually been alive to say it. In this way, the ideas of the Talmud are not limited to any generation or any time, but are unlimited in scope. And ideas can be shared from generation to generation, questions raised and answered, the Amita Shel Torah uncovered, the truth of Torah revealed for all, as well as practical teachings that now become accessible to deal with new situations as they would arise. Of course, the task of compiling this material obviously took many, many decades and continued long after Ravashi's death. We all know, those who learn, every area of life is scrutinized. Each of the mitzvahs, civil law, family life, marital law, bracha, Shabbos, Yom Tovim, the human psyche, the occasional medical advice, as well as, again, in a systematic fashion, regular passages of Agadah. There's no Agadah in the Mishnah. Agadah is nothing less than the philosophy of Yadus relayed in the form of stories and parables and, of course, commentaries on the Tanakh. The Talmud is written with such precision that every word and phrase is subject to analysis and scrutiny. Even the order itself of how different passages are put in the Talmud is analyzed for hints. Why is the subject here and not elsewhere? You have a few masechtos, like Nozir, Sota, which begin with the discussion. Why is this here and not somewhere else? So from the juxtapositions, we're able to learn. The word became sacred, where people, of course, who cherish the word, who hallowed the word in Tanakh, and now the word of the Talmud became sacred as well. Sacred even for more than the obvious reasons. The Gemara says in Gittin, Daf Samach Amud Beis, Ksov luchas advar ma'ila. Ki al pi advar ma'ila karatit chabris bas Yisrael. And God says to Moshe, write this down, but al pi advar ma'ila. The real covenant with the Jewish people is through the Talmud, is through the Dvarm Shebal Peh, that which is oral. And the Mefarshim notes very cogently what the Gemara means to say, among several possible interpretations, is that the time will come, by this time it had come already, when other religions had embraced, or accepted at least, the Torah Shebichsav. Other nations believed in the Bible. Only Jews accept the Torah Shebal Peh. And therefore the Torah Shebal Peh, the oral Torah, that became the substance of the covenant between Klal Yisrael and HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Not only that, the very act of learning became not just a pragmatic means of understanding right and wrong or how to perform the mitzvos in a technical fashion, but learning became an act of Avodas Hashem of the highest order. Now, of course, it always was that, even going back to the time of the Tanakh. But here you had, if not the average person, certainly a large segment of the society, they now had access to Torah discussions. They had material of substance, of heft, that they could engage in Torah discussions as well. In the language of the Bala Tanya, a person studies the Talmud, probes machshavta yisbarach. We are probing the very thoughts of God. The Talmud Bavli consists of almost 2,700 two-sided pages. It's very hard to get a precise count. One of the mistakes I saw in some of the lists is that they forget that every Masechta starts with Peis, not Aleph. So like Brachos has 64 Dafim, but it really has 63 Dafim, because you can't count Aleph. But nonetheless, you learn one per day, then it takes a little less than 7.5 years to finish the entire Talmud Bavli. Imagine then how long it took to put it in its present form, which has an internal coherence that is accessible only to those who immerse themselves in it. It's clear why Chazal referred to it as the Yam HaTalmud, the Sea of the Talmud. It looks endless, but beneath the surface, it's even deeper, as the hundreds of commentaries on it, written on it, to mine every utterance can attest. And because it's the font of Jewish wisdom, it has long had its detractors, its enemies, and its destroyers. Whenever, wherever Talmud Torah is under attack, during the Crusades, by the Church, by the Nazis, by the Communists, the Talmud was always the first work sought out for suppression, and often for destruction through burning. Christians, especially renegade Jews, delighted in finding, so to speak, offensive statements, wrenched from context, sometimes with its meaning simply distorted. The Talmud became subject in different centuries, much later on, but we'll get back to it, but as recently as the 19th century, to a rigid censorship, to eliminate what they assumed to be Christological references or other passages that underscored the truth of Torah and the falsehood of paganism or other religions. It's important to remember that the Talmud is not the Torah Shebal Peh. It's not the same. The Talmud is a record of some of the discussions of the oral law. Its essence, the ideas and the formulas by which the various disputes can be understood, that essence remains oral. And so the Talmud reinforced the necessity of having a Rebbe, of learning from a teacher who had mastered the method of Talmudic study known as Lamdus. The Talmud's not the type book that you could just, you know, read in translation as one would read a novel or a newspaper. It has to be studied, learned, and one has to acquire the skills from a master who possesses them. And the subjects we learn were indelibly shaped by the Talmud as well. So the Gemara says in Kiddushin Daf Lamed, La'olam yeshalish odom shinosov, a person should always divide his life into three parts. Others say it means divide your day into three parts. Shlish b'mikra, shlish b'mishnah, shlish b'talmud. One-third Tanakh, one-third Mishnah, one-third Talmud. Talmud Rashi says there, Svaros etanei stimaseyan shal mishnayos, Ulatartsam Bamasha Sosra Zoazo. The reasoning, the formula, the ideas that underlie the Mishnayos, and to explain where each one, when one seems to contradict the other. Tosfos says in Sanhedrin Chavdalim and Aleph, Peirush Rabbeinu Tam, again, the curriculum the Chazal ordained for all Jews, a third of the day Tanakh, a third Mishnah, a third Gemara. Rabbeinu Tam said, "Debitalmud shalonu onupotun atzmenu." We're exempt from that curriculum because in the Talmud Bavli, that's a mixture of everything. You have Pesukim quoted, you have Mishnayos, you have Gemara. So Rabbeinu Tam held, and this has become a Shita Ladoros, a person who learns Talmud Bavli, he needs nothing else. That's one of the Gemara's drushas. Bava means a mixture, so everything is mixed in. You have everything there. Sometimes, interestingly, because everything was handwritten, you'll find that a pasuk is not transcribed correctly in the Talmud. A word will be missing, or the spelling will be changed, and people who learn their Tanakh from the Talmud, they'll very often get it wrong. Now, the Rambam, at the beginning of Hilchos Talmud Torah, in Halacha Yud Gimel, says, where do we say you need this tripartite structure in learning? When you've started, then you have to have grounding in all three areas. When a person grows in wisdom, the person then is able not to be involved in Torah Shebichsav at all, but just focus on Torah Shebalpeh. He should read Torah Shebichsav be'itim yuzumanim, regular times, v'divrei Shmuel, shouldn't forget the psukim, but the yifne kol yomav l'gemara bilvad. He should focus his energies and devote his time to Gemara l'fi rochav sheish b'libo v'yishuv daito, in accordance with his intellectual capacities. Now, as the Rambam says, this focus on Gemara, which remains until today, has its downside as well. It's already pointed out by Rav Natra Nigon, just a few centuries later. Nismichu ala Talmud bilvad ve'ozu mishnah amikra u'mishnah. We know that to be true. He said already by his day, people just study Gemara and they've abandoned completely the study of Tanakh or Mishnah. So it comes out that over the centuries, and it's true until today, most Jews, most, are simply not very proficient in Tanakh. And the sad fact is, most Christians could shame us in their simple knowledge of what the Bible says. Now, there was something of a revival of Tanakh study in the last 150 years, but because it was identified with the Maskilim, who are anti-Talmud, it did not catch on very quickly. Today it's somewhat different. You have many Talmidei Chachamim studying Tanakh, although most yeshivas, as we well know, still emphasize Gemara and only Gemara. So the advantage, the disadvantage is clear. The advantage is that in the Gemara, we find almost everything we need in the Torah. It's true, we no longer paskin from the Gemara, but the Rambam writes that the Gaonim accepted the Talmud Bavli as authoritative for all Jews, for all generations, and that's how we exist until today. Rav Ashi and Ravina died within 5 years of each other, but the editing of the Talmud continued for at least another 60 years, with the absolutely final product not complete until the work of the Rabbanan Saborai, well into the 6th century, but that's for next time. It was the clarifiers. One of the points about this couple, Ravina had a son named Mar, who contributed to our lexicon one of the most familiar tfilos. Gemara says he would say after davening every day, Elokai Nitzor Lashoni Meiro Usfasai Midaber Mirmo. That was Ravina's son, and of course that is appended to every Amida, every Shmona Esrei that we recite. After Rav Ashi's death, he was succeeded by Mereimar, self-famous with his partner, the Reish Galusa, Mar Zutra, then Ravidi Baravan, who died in 452. The seventh and last generation of Amoraim was finally highlighted by the service of Mar Bar Rav Ashi. He was called Mar as an honorary title. His name was Tavyomi. He was a great Talmud Chacham. He became the Rosh Yeshiva Moshe Mechassi in his own right, but in 455. That is to say, 28 years after his father's death, with two or three intervening Rosh Yeshiva. After that, they turned to Rav Ashi's son, despite his greatness, the position of Rosh Yeshiva then was not hereditary. That did not come until much later in Jewish life. It was Mar Bar Avashi who led the Jewish people out of the spiritual morass of Yazdegerd II, and for 13 difficult years after that, years of much turmoil and suffering. So what happened? After Yazdegerd II was killed by the serpent, assassinated, his son Hormuzd III succeeded him, preempting his older brother Firuz. It's very interesting what happened. Firuz was talented, the Russia, we'll get to that, talented, so his father sent him to govern a distant province. He should learn the basics of leadership, you know, run something. We don't have that custom in America, by the way. You need not run anything before you become president. But in ancient Persia, Firuz was sent to a distant province, so when his father was killed, he was weeks and months away from the capital. So his brother Hormuzd seized power, Firuz, being no slouch, 2 years later, came back, captured and deposed his brother, and Firuz means in Persian the victor, they had great names, he became one of the most evil monarchs we would encounter, and really the exception to the Babylonian archetype. Not helping at all was a famine, a terrible famine that afflicted Persia for 7 years, beginning in 464. In 470, Rashurgon writes, Firuz arrested Amemar Huno, who was the son of the Reish Gus of the time, and Misharshia, another one of the Amoraim. The latter two he executed on the 18th of Teves, it's all recorded, and Amemar he killed 2 months later in Adar. In 474, Firuz closed all the shuls in Bavel. Worse than that, Rav Shira writes, Visnakitu b'nei Yehudai lam goshei. He kidnapped Jewish children and he turned them over to the Magi, the Zoroastrian priests. Now Rav Shira Gaon is obviously scant with details because he lived there centuries later, but nonetheless, the Persians until today very proud of Firuz I, his accomplishments, not with Jews but elsewhere. So just like the Megillus Esther is silent about Ahasuerus' evil because they lived there too, so too we don't know much about it except to say the situation was grim and even gruesome. But all bad things come to an end. Firuz I was killed in battle through a very clever deception of the Huns. Leave it to the Huns. They lured him out. Firuz had a more powerful army. So they came and asked to meet him to surrender, and when he came to their surrender meeting, they ambushed and killed him, and then defeated his army. This in 484. So he was succeeded by his brother Balash, who was a more magnanimous personality. He revoked the decrees, and the Jewish condition improved markedly. The Jews then were led by a colleague of Ravina II named Rabba Tosfa'a. Tosfa'a, because of the additions to the Talmud that he made even after the death of Ravina II. Then in 476, an important year, another Rav Yossi became the head of Bavel Jewry. He led for 38 years. Humpadisa reclaimed its prominence. In his day, Yeshua said, Istayim Talmuda. It was finished, except for some finishing touches that were put on later. 476 marks not just the beginning of the rule of Rav Yossi, but another momentous occasion, the final collapse of the Western Roman Empire, which had been ravaged throughout the century, and now is taken over by Germanic tribes. Its history muted for centuries to come during the Dark Ages of Western man. Just to summarize, the Jewish world of the 5th century was turbulent and unstable. And the additions of Kriyat Shema to the daily davening, early in the morning, and on Shabbos and Musaf, are reminders of that evil. Augustine put it into the Christian mind that it's better to keep the Jews around as persecuted witnesses than to kill them outright. And Christianity found that temporal governance was not as simple in actuality as it was in theory. They thrashed about at their enemies, but to no avail. Importantly, you can imagine the effect it had on the Jews of the time, the great behemoth, Rome, that had destroyed the Beis HaMikdash and tormented generations of Jews, that great empire deteriorated and disappeared. The fate of all empires, even the most powerful, that interfere with Jewish destiny. But Golos is Golos, and even the edifice of Babylonian Jewry showed signs of cracking, and we had to weather the storms of Yazdegerd II and Firuz I. But lurking in the background, just like 3 centuries earlier, was the prescience of the Gedolei Hador, mainly Rav Ashi, who committed then, during that turbulent time, committed to writing the Torah Shebaal Peh in a way that would not only shape, but actually define Jewish life until today. Just like Rav Yehuda Nosi used his friendship and the serenity of the Antoninus era to put the Mishnah writing, so too Rav Ashi was prescient enough to use the serenity of the Yazdegerd I era to begin the process of committing the Talmud Bavli to writing as well. In all, there were only 40 generations. Think about it. It's a long time in years, but only 40 generations, individuals and their lifespan, separating Moshe and Sinai from Rav Ashi. That's 40 people. The Rambam listed others as well. Roughly 40 years for each of those giants. That itself makes the Mesorah not only an article of faith, but very plausible as well. The Mesorah is very accessible. People ask, well, you know, maybe the transmission became distorted. You're only talking 40 people. And of the 40 people, each of them were the Gedolei Hador, and a good number of them were Nevi'im as well. So both in transmission and substance, from Moshe to Rav Ashi, we have that direct chain that we can trace. The Talmud would be our companion in the most joyous and placid moments in our history, and our comfort when the entire world was falling apart around us, especially in the 6th century of the Common Era, when mankind regressed into paganism and barbarism, and Jewish life adapted to new challenges, especially a world in which God's Word seemed to have a smaller and smaller audience. That for next week. I thank you all very much. See you.